This is a People First Radio podcast.
What's it like meeting someone who's committed murder? Or spending time in solitary confinement? How does money work for people in Canadian prisons? Under the pen name David Dorson, a former inmate has penned columns on these and a variety of other subjects. Dorson went through arrest, case disposition, imprisonment, and parole in Ontario a few years ago. His series of around 25 columns on different aspects of his experiences in prison can be found on the website law360.ca. I spoke with Dorson to learn more about his experiences of prison from the inside.
As you know, I write a column about my experience in the prison system and with the criminal justice system under a pen name, which is David Dorson. And so that's the name I'll use for purposes of this interview, which is not my real name. I spent about 15 months in prison a number of years ago, and then another 20 months or so on parole.
And can you tell me about maybe what kind of a facility you were in?
Well, I was in several. So when you're first sentenced, and if you get a federal sentence, which is 2 years or more, you spend some time in a provincial jail waiting for them to transfer you into the federal system. And that, for me, was about 3 weeks, all of which was in segregation. So I was completely by myself for 19 days, I guess. Then I got transferred into the federal system, and I spent about 2.5 months in, I've forgotten the name for it now, but an assessment unit, which is what happens when you come into the federal system, because you're going to be there for a while. So they put you in an assessment unit. They have a few of them around the country, and you spend some time there while they sort out what level of security they're putting you in. And then I spend most of my time, about a year, in a minimum security.
So can you tell me, you've written a blog on the subject of provincial versus federal prisons,
right,
and why you feel maybe sometimes a slightly longer sentence can make someone's life better in a lot of ways. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, in Canada, the boundary is anything under 2 years, you're spending in a provincial jail. Anything over 2 years as a sentence, you're in the federal system. But the provincial jails are really much worse places than many of the federal prisons, especially if you're going to end up in a medium or a minimum security, because all the provincial jails are maximum security, all of them. And they have almost no programs or anything else that you do get in the federal system. There's so much movement in and out of provincial jails. Most of the people in provincial jails in Canada, about 70%, haven't been convicted. They're being held on remand, which I think most people don't realize. 70% of provincial prisoners have not been found guilty of anything, and yet they're still locked up. So there's a lot of coming and going. So provincial jails do not offer education programs. They do not offer much in the way of recreation programs. They're often very crowded. You can be three people in a cell sleeping with your head next to the toilet on the floor for weeks or months at a time. It's harder to visit. All of that is worse. All the conditions are worse in provincial jails than they are for most federal prisoners. Also, there's no parole. I shouldn't say there's no parole, but there's very little parole in the provincial system. So if you come into the federal system with a three-year sentence, you could be out on parole in a year thereabouts. But if you go into the provincial system with a two-year sentence, you're going to do mostly the full 2 years inside. So worse conditions and a longer period of time. Oh, also, if you get a two-year provincial sentence, you can have up to 3 years of probation tacked on it. But if you get a federal sentence of over 2 years, there's no probation.
So I don't know, what was your experience of maybe the line between those two things? Like, was that something you were conscious of when you were going through the legal process?
No. And not only was I not conscious of it, but my lawyers weren't conscious of it either. In fact, I was quite surprised to discover how many criminal lawyers know very little about the prison system and how it works.
You mentioned earlier on in our conversation that you spent some time in segregation. I think you said 19 days. Can you tell me what that experience was like? What happened on a kind of day-to-day level?
What happened on a day-to-day level was essentially nothing. You are by yourself 24 hours a day, 23 and a half of them locked up in a cell. There is no TV, no radio, some of the time nothing even to read. The first few days, the only thing I had to read was a Bible, which you can always get in jail. You can always get a Bible, which is why I asked for one, so I'd at least have something to read, because I'm a person who loves reading. The lights are on 24 hours a day. The sleeping conditions are bad. The food is bad. You're supposed to get at least half an hour a day of exercise. I got 3 exercise periods in 19 days, all by myself in a concrete room. That was exercise, walking around a concrete room. Showers, you're supposed to get a shower every second day. I got 4 in 19 days, and I had to ask for them. So that's a pretty, pretty tough world to survive in, because you're entirely on your own. I could make some phone calls, and I could write letters and get letters.
Did you have a sense of why you were kind of going through that 19 days at the start?
Well, there's two. You mean why was I in segregation,
yes,
or why did it take so long?
Both.
Well, I was in segregation because my case was fairly high profile, and the prison was worried, the jail was worried that something might happen to me if I were in the general population. Someone would decide to beat me up, which happens pretty regularly in those places. And they didn't want bad publicity from it. Not that they cared about me being beaten up, because people are beaten up all the time, but they did not want bad publicity about it. So they stuck me in segregation. At first, they told me it would take about a week. Normally, it takes a week or 10 days to do a transfer into the federal system. For some reason that I don't know, mine took 19 days.
And you talked about phone calls and letters. Can you give me a sense of what communication with the outside world was like?
Well, when you're in SEG, in a provincial jail, and in provincial jails generally, it's pretty tough. You have to find paper somewhere. You have to find a writing implement somewhere, or get them to give you one, because they're not automatically supplied. In provincial jails, you were supposed to get 2 free letters a week, but I can tell you that none of the free letters I wrote was ever delivered to anybody. And this is a common experience from other people in provincial jails. The letters get thrown away. They never actually get put in the mail. I had people who told me they saw guards doing that. However, if you could write letters with stamps, they mostly did go through. And I did start getting letters because I was lucky enough to have friends and family who organized themselves to write to me. So I did start getting letters within, I guess, about a week. Phone calls, the way it works when you're in segregation is they bring a phone to the door of your cell and they pass. You can reach through a hole in the door to dial the number. And then you have to kind of half crouch on the floor to hold the handset, because the handset isn't long enough that you could sit on the floor with it or stand up with it. So if you can imagine it, you got this big steel door with a hole in it, and then you can dial the number through that, and then you can hold the handset and talk to somebody. But it depends on a guard being willing to bring you the phone. And sometimes they were and sometimes they weren't. And it depends on whoever you want to call being there. Plus, the calls are all collect calls and cost $1 a minute.
What is the financial situation like when you're in prison in terms of the cost of things that, you know, you use on the day to day, and then just everything from your life and the outside world that you will presumably return to one day?
If you don't have somebody who can send you money inside, it's very, very tough. Very tough. In the provincial system, if you don't have any money, you don't have any money. You can't buy anything. You only get what they give you, which is not very much, I can tell you. In the federal system, it's much more sophisticated. There is a daily, what they call pay, which is about $6 a day, out of which $6 a day for Monday to Friday, out of which they deduct 30% for room and board, and another amount for telephone calls. No, not for telephone calls, for the telephone service. You actually have to pay in addition to that for every call you make. And the telephone rates, as I suggested, are ridiculously high, both in jails and in federal prisons. It's outrageous. You know, you and I can talk essentially for nothing as long as we want to. But in a Canadian prison, you're going to be paying 60 cents a minute, sort of minimally, to call anybody. So it's crazy. But the jails and prisons are getting a rebate from the phone companies. So it's a revenue item for them. So basically, you know, $6 a day, like if you were in the federal system, if you are a person who's fairly young and fairly physically active and working out a lot, which a lot of guys were, the food you get isn't enough to sustain you. So you basically have to buy additional food. But I was spending $100 a month on phone calls. And that was just, you know, phoning my family on a regular basis. So it's expensive to be inside. And as I say, if you don't have someone who can put money on the books for you, it's really going to stunt what you can do. Not to mention things like being able to buy some clothes for yourself or a book or a magazine or, you know, whatever else you might want.
Are there places that you can buy things in prison?
There is a system through which you can buy, which is run by the prison. So you can only buy the things that they have on offer, which is a pretty limited selection at pretty high prices. You can't buy anything independently. And it's subject to arbitrary change. So, for example, at one point you could buy this magazine, and then 2 months later you couldn't buy that magazine. And, of course, you never know why. Just someone says, no, not allowed.
Last year on the program, I spoke with Ben Perrin about his book Indictment, which contained a number of accounts from people within the prison system. And one kind of thread of that book was that there's a lot of crime that goes on within prisons. Was that something that you were able to experience from the inside of the system or get a sense of?
Well, they're generally pretty violent places. So I already talked about people getting beaten up, which happens a lot in provincial jails. And really, frankly, with the full knowledge of guards quite often. It happens in the federal prisons. There is violence, especially at the maximum security level. There's not much violence in minimum security because basically if you get in a fight in minimum security, they're going to ship you out back to medium, and nobody wants to be in medium when they could be in minimum. So basically they're safer places in that way. But there's certainly other kinds of crime. For example, drugs. Everybody I know has been in a provincial jail says drugs are widely, widely available in them. In the federal prison where I was, there were some. I didn't see a lot of them, but I wasn't looking for them, of course. Certainly tobacco, cigarettes, which you're not supposed to be smoking, but which people are smoking, which are quite expensive inside the system. You know, cell phones, people get cell phones smuggled in. Sure, there's a lot of that stuff going on.
What was the process of transitioning from prison back into society like for you?
Well, it wasn't bad for me because I had a family and a home that I could go back to. But about 25% of the people in Ontario say who are released from provincial jails are homeless. So they have huge problems. I didn't have to find a job. Finding a job with a criminal record is very, very difficult. For example, one guy I knew who was a musician and made his living as a musician, the only work he could get when he got out was asbestos, clearing asbestos. That's what he could get to earn a living from. So it's hard to get housing because people don't want to rent to you if you have a record. It's hard to find work. The services are totally inadequate. So we're quite happy to punish people, but we're not very interested at all in making it easier for people to live a life that would not involve them in crime.
I imagine there might be people who would listen to a conversation like this and say things like, you know, jail isn't supposed to be nice or jail isn't supposed to be pleasant. What would your response to maybe that kind of sentiment be?
Well, the first thing I'd say is it isn't pleasant. It isn't nice. It's a place of loss and deprivation. The Supreme Court of Canada said that the purpose of punishment is the deprivation of liberty, but that's only one small part of the punishment. many other things happen. Marriages break down. People can't see their kids. People lose custody of their kids. People lose their jobs. People lose their houses. This is all part of the punishment, not the one the judge sentences you to, but the one you actually experience. And it never ends. In that sense, every sentence is a life sentence. You still can't get into the United States 20 years after you were sentenced for shoplifting. You know, you may be denied a passport. You may face questioning every time you come back into the country. As I said, it's hard to get employment. It's hard to find housing. And those things never go away. Whether you got a 3-year sentence or a 30-year sentence, in that sense, every sentence is the rest of your life. So what I want to say to people is, believe me, the people we put in jail or prison are paying, and they are paying a lot. You don't see a lot of it, but they are paying a lot.
Are there any things you think are maybe the biggest parts of your experience on the inside that you think other people who haven't spent time in that world wouldn't be aware of that you want to share?
Absolutely. And one of the biggest is I met many guys who are lifers. In the minimum security, there are quite a few lifers. It takes them 20 years to get there. You know, if you have a life sentence, you're starting out in maximum usually, or maybe in medium. It could take you 20 years inside before you get to minimum, or 30 years in some cases. Guys have been in jail 30 years, they're finally in minimum security. I met many of them, dozens and dozens. And what I want to say is these guys are pretty much like anybody else. So they actually killed someone. It's, you know, that's a serious thing that nobody should regard that trivially. But 30 years ago, and yet we are still keeping these people in prison, which is no benefit to anyone, doesn't do the victims any good. I believe I understand the anger people feel if they're a victim or know someone who's a victim of a crime. I can see that people are angry about that, and I understand why they're angry about it. But if we think about it, it's just not a good way to deal with that, because it turns the system into a system that's about people getting vengeance. And that's not what the justice system is supposed to be. So the point I want to make is a lot of people who are in that system would be perfectly good neighbors. I've met a lot of guys who are lifers who I'd be happy to have as a next door neighbor. Maybe not 30 years ago when they were sentenced, but now. And so I think the system just needs more compassion in it. And the flip side of that is we need to do a lot more for victims of crime, because mostly now the main thing we offer victims is a harsh punishment. That doesn't make their lives any better, doesn't take away the hurt that they've incurred, the suffering that they've had, the losses that they've had. So if we had better services and supports for victims, that would help us a long way in having a more compassionate system.
Another thing I'm curious about is, you know, you share your experiences in a very public way on this kind of, in this blog that's shared on the John Howard Society, Canada yep. Law 360. Do you find that as someone who has been to prison, a lot of what you were talking about as every sentence is a life sentence, it's harder to find employment, to fit back into society because of the stigma associated with having been incarcerated. Yeah. Do you find that plays a part in, you know, suggesting reforms to the prison system as someone who has experienced it?
I don't see much interest in the system in reform. There are a lot of people around Canada. One of the interesting things about criminal justice is that there's a lot of agreement among the experts that we are doing the wrong things, more than there is in most fields. And yet that doesn't have much stake in driving policy, because policy is driven by politics, and politics are largely driven by emotion. So I'm not seeing that there's a large appetite, because if we had the appetite, we already know the things that we need to be doing and that some other places are doing.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to this conversation today?
Well, one thing I would say is about the evidence. You know, as I mentioned in the last response, there's a lot of really good evidence about criminal justice and what would be effective and what is ineffective. And a lot of that work is done by Canadians. There are really terrific work done. I was going to mention that the the Canadian Civil Liberties Association just produced a really good report on bail and why the argument about jail, not bail, is a ridiculous argument, a fallacious argument. But what we don't have in criminal justice is a good way of putting the evidence in front of people to try to influence the political debate. So if we had mechanisms to do that in a better way, expert panels, something like the Law Reform Commission of Canada used to be before the Conservatives got rid of it. If we had more things like that, it might induce more people to think a little differently about the issues and not just to respond so viscerally as people tend to do.
David Dorson is the pen name of someone who went through arrest, case disposition, imprisonment, and parole in Ontario a few years ago. He's shared parts of his experience in a series of columns available on the websites of Law 360 Canada and the John Howard Society of Canada.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.